Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. Jason Croft at the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was with us for hour number one. Almost 1,000 people died in Jonestown in November of 1978. They had followed Jim Jones because they believed that he could lead them to a better life. They also believed that they could leave at any time. Little did they know that the mass suicide that would take them had been planned years in advance. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Julia Shears. She's a journalist, writer, and author of a recently published book that's titled 1,000 Lives: The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. That's the subtitle. Free Press is the publisher of the book. And in her book, what she tries to do is profile some of the members of the People's Temple in what she says is an effort to restore the victims their humanity as individuals. We'll be talking this morning with Julia Shears, and as we talk, questions and comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. If you'd like to call in, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send in your thoughts, comments, questions by email, you can do that too. And the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here you'd like to join the conversation, you are certainly welcome to do that. And Ms. Shears, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. You know, I think that we've forgotten, or at least I've forgotten, I think probably a lot of people have forgotten, how shocking and chilling an event this was that's now been more than, what, 32 years, is that?
It's been 33 years.
33 years. So now more than three decades ago. Maybe, though, if people can cast their mind back to seeing the photographs of the people there lying dead, they'll remember what it was like when they heard the story and saw those pictures.
Right. It was on the cover of both Time and Newsweek the next week, the mass pile of bodies lying in the jungle.
Yeah.
That's what I remember.
Yeah. Over the other thing that maybe people might surprise people that certainly we know a lot of people died. 913 people died, and a third of them were children. But there actually were a number of people who survived.
There were. Some people managed to escape that morning with a congressman who had gone down to investigate whether people were being held against their will. And another group of people actually hiked out through the jungle.
Mm-hmm. So I think that, and you, one of the things that you did in the course of writing the book is that you went in and you tried to see if you could find people who had been through this experience, in fact, who were willing to talk to you about it.
I did. I follow five people in the group, and that's my hook, because everybody knows how Jonestown ends, but you don't know how my five people end. They go, you know that they're going to meet Jim Jones somewhere in the United States, join his church, and move down to Guyana. And so hopefully the reader will be so engaged with their lives, you know, by the end of the book that they'll be completely, you know, mesmerized by the story.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's something else I think here is an important point. And I use the term suicide in describing this over time. That is the word that has been used. And
right.
Reconsidering this now, particularly through the lens of your book, I think that may be the wrong term. Maybe somebody did go to their death willingly. Certainly children didn't. Do you end up questioning or wanting people to question whether, in fact, calling this a mass suicide is correct?
Well, the central argument of my book is that it's mass murder.
Mm-hmm.
I found evidence that Jim Jones was planning to kill his followers from the early 70s, and the Jonestown Massacre happened in 1978. But in the early 70s, he was already talking to his inner circle about his fantasy of killing people to make a statement in favor of socialism. That's what he said it was about.
Mm-hmm.
So he was talking about loading people onto buses and driving them off the Golden Gate Bridge here in San Francisco. And then he talked about loading them onto an airplane and crashing it. He actually sent one of his lovers to flight school. She got her private pilot's license and was working on her commercial license when he came up with an even better idea, Jonestown, where he could seclude as many of his followers as possible and exact a much higher death toll.
And this, I think, this is perhaps all the sadder when you realize, and I did not, but it's again one of the things that comes through the book is that some of the people who were fortunate enough to survive this were actually condemned rather than being understood as victims.
I think you mentioned the pictures on the top, the news covers, Newsweek and Time. Those pictures were so repulsive to the American public. I don't think they could get beyond their sense of disgust at what happened. You know, I think that, that's where the whole phrase "drinking the Kool-Aid" comes from. It's entered our cultural lexicon. That is the fact, or the thought rather, that these people willingly lined up to drink poison. Well, in my research and with my interviews, I found out that was clearly not the case. On that last night, they had no choice but to die. They were surrounded by one line of security people armed with guns and another line of security people armed with crossbows that were pointed at them. And Jim Jones let them know that if they didn't drink the poison, they would be shot. So that's why I say it was mass murder. They weren't given the choice to leave that night.
Yeah.
Jim Jones wanted them to die.
This is, it makes you reconsider, and maybe it makes one wonder, makes one wish that, I'll speak for myself. It makes me wish that I'd never actually even uttered that phrase, because I certainly have. And it's become part of the lexicon. But I also wonder how many people who have used that phrase actually know what that's referring to.
Right. I think it's completely divorced of the origin these days. The young people, who are born, 30 and under, say, many of them have never heard of Jonestown, but they know that phrase. So, the fact that it's so bandied about and so commonplace, I think every time it's uttered, it's an offense to the victims of Jim Jones, and especially to the children who died down there. They didn't willingly drink the Kool-Aid. It was poured down their throats.
Our guest for this hour of focus is Julia Shears. She's a journalist, author. She is the author of a memoir, which maybe we'll talk a little bit about in a moment, titled Jesus Land. She's also written for a number of different publications, and she has a new book out, recently published. The title of the book is 1,000 Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. Free Press is the publisher. And again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about how you got involved in this story. And you didn't, as my understanding is, that you didn't start out to write a work of journalism about Jonestown. You were actually writing a novel, and that was your doorway into this story.
That's right. So what happened after I wrote my memoir, Jesus Land, I was casting about, and I came up with the idea for a satirical novel. It was going to be about a charismatic preacher who takes over this fictional Indiana town. And then I remembered, hey, Jim Jones was from Indiana. I got online, and I found that the FBI had released this trove of documents that agents had collected from Jonestown, 50,000 pieces of paper and almost 1,000 audio tapes, and that no one had used this evidence to write a history, essentially, of Jonestown. And then I'm a journalist by trade, and so I'm like, okay, I don't know about the novel and fiction writing, but I know how to do this. And so I basically switched horses and started working on this nonfiction history.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that this had been the business of using this material had been made a little bit easier, because after some period of time when it was just sitting in kind of randomly in boxes, some researchers and scholars had actually done this painstaking effort of going through it and actually collating it in a way that actually made it more usable.
Yeah, so what happened was one of the victims and relatives sued the FBI to release this information. Mm-hmm. And so she compelled the FBI to release the information after years and years of lawsuits, and they did. And so she has written several academic kind of, you know, race and people's temple and some of these academic works. I was more interested in doing a kind of layperson's introduction to Jonestown or a popular history of what happened that last year in Jonestown.
We have a caller here to talk with. Why don't we do that? And again, other people who are listening are welcome to call in with their thoughts, ask questions. 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have someone here calling in on our toll-free line. The caller here is in Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Thank you, David. I'll just ask a question and ring off. If your guest can articulate any similarities between Jonestown and Waco. Thank you.
All right. Had you thought about any parallels between Jonestown and Waco?
I don't draw any conclusions or parallels in my book. What I can say is that they both, you know, David Koresh and Jim Jones, as far as I know, started out as regular ministers, preachers, who then became consumed by their power and became something else. And, you know, we're very charismatic and we're interested in the amount of control they could have over their followers. For example, Jim Jones started out his career as a student preacher in a Methodist church in Indianapolis. And then he started reinterpreting the Bible and, in fact, decided that he was no longer a Christian because the Bible contains what he said were so many inaccuracies and contradictions. And so he started having his own interpretation of the scriptures and putting himself in God's place. He was the savior of his followers now. And so I think that's a very dangerous combination, this kind of rethinking of the standard scriptures and putting yourself as the leader, as the almighty and powerful, and even, he would say, divine, capable of producing miracles. So I think those are some similarities, the charisma and also the origins, which I believe were Bible-based once upon a time in David Koresh's case as well.
Mm. Well, I know that your intention, as you explained a little bit at the beginning, was to try to write about the people, the Jim's own followers, not so much about him. Certainly a lot has been written about him. At the same time, you can't really talk about the People's Temple without talking about him.
That's right. Well, the thing is, you know, that's what he wanted. He wanted to go down in history. He wanted to be famous. And this really, along with his desire to control people, was the reason that he orchestrated the mass murder. You know, I wanted to talk about what it was like to be a rank-and-file member of this church, decide that you're going to go down to what Jones painted as a socialist utopia, and check it out. You know, take the family down, take a month off from work. You get down there. You know, Jones has been sending back all these movies about how wonderful it is and everyone's happy and singing. And then you get down there. It's a two-day boat trip up these jungle rivers. He takes away your passport. He takes away your money. And he tells you, you're not going home. If you want to go home, you can swim home. Right? That's what I wanted to capture, what that was like for the regular member of Jim Jones Church.
So people, again, to go back to this point that make sure that people understand that the individuals who died there didn't die willingly. They did go there willingly because they thought that there was a certain promise of a better life. So that's what they thought they were going for. But in fact, once they got there, they realized that they were trapped.
Right. And, you know, here in San Francisco, Jim Jones was a leader. You know, he was a kingmaker. He got the mayor, the district attorney. He got this whole slate of politicians elected in 1975. He was really looked up to here for all the services he was providing for the community as well. All kinds of outreach, soup kitchens, medical services for destitute elderly, child watch. And so he really had this reputation. And again, people went to Jonestown thinking that they could return whenever they wanted, not knowing that Jim Jones had these very dark plans in store for them.
So he was, the thing was, if you would have to understand the appeal of this man,
right,
from early on, from his youth, when he started this first church in Indianapolis, it seems that he was, had a very, a real strong, some sort of personal power that drew people to him. And one of the things that no doubt there in Indianapolis and afterwards that some people find very appealing to him was this this very strong commitments to bringing people together, social justice. It was a big thing that this just first church he had in Indianapolis, there were black people and white people worshiping together. That was in Indianapolis. That would have been very, very unusual.
Well, that's right. You know, in the mid-1950s, he was at the cusp of the civil rights movement in Indianapolis. He was integrating lunch counters. He would take groups of his integrated congregation and drive them to these whites-only lunch counters and march in, sit down to see how they'd be received. He was taking them to white churches in the richer neighborhoods and marching in to see how they would be received. And again, a lot of times where they were met with hostility and racism, even in the church. So he was very outspoken, and he also had this dream of social equality that appealed to many African Americans who felt that the civil rights movement wasn't pushing hard enough or far enough. You know, he was on TV saying he was going to fast until such and such a restaurant opened up their lunch counters to serve blacks, for example.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience, because we mentioned Jesus Land, the memoir that you wrote, and it seems that in fact that one of the first people who agreed to talk with you, one of the survivors, someone who had been there as a boy, really decided that he could talk to you. Perhaps he felt that because he read your memoir, had some sense of who you were and your experiences, and it must have been that he thought you maybe would have a better understanding of him and what he had been through because of what you had been through. I'm sorry, that was a terribly labored. But maybe tell us a little bit about your experiences growing up and what you write about in Jesus Land.
Right. So my memoir, Jesus Land, is about growing up on the outskirts of West Lafayette, Indiana, rural, with an adopted black brother named David, and we were the same age, and it's really about how our relationship was affected growing up in this very conservative Christian environment where there was also a lot of racism. So it's about the sibling bond, and it's also about being sent away as teenagers to a Christian reform school in the Dominican Republic. This place called Escuela Caribe, a Caribbean school, beautiful name, but it wasn't in reality. So there were some eerie parallels between what happened in Jonestown and my reform school as far as the discipline of the children. At my school, they would stage boxing matches between kids, the same at Jonestown. They would shear their heads of hair if kids tried to run away, same thing at Jonestown. They made them, if they were in trouble, they couldn't speak to anybody. They had to run from place to place. Same thing at my school. So there are a lot of these little parallels that Tommy Bogue, who was a teenager when he was sent to Jonestown to straighten him out, you know, get him away from inner San Francisco where he was running around, skipping school, smoking pot, that Tommy Bogue, some 30 years later, recognized. And after I sent him my book, he was willing then to speak with me.
It seems that here you have all kinds of different people here. We have adults from different kinds of backgrounds who go for different reasons. And then we have children that went there because their parents brought them there, that it wasn't their choice to go there. And that was his reason for being there. And the thing about his experience is, at least early on, it was kind of a great adventure for him.
Well, Well, that's right, and that's what most people don't understand, because when the members of People's Temple moved to Guyana, they did so with great enthusiasm. You know, the idea, it was kind of this the 70s feeling of starting this great utopia where everyone would be equal. There would be no racism or sexism or elitism or classism or any of the other evil isms. So they were going down there, you know, very enthusiastically to participate in this great experiment, this great socialist experiment. And Tommy Bogue, you know, he moved down there before Jones moved down, and he said the jungle was my playground. He'd run around with a native Amerindian, and, you know, he'd be building cottages alongside his father during the day, and then they'd have a movie and pops to drink at night, and there was just this real air of camaraderie and solidarity. But then once Jim Jones moved down there, prompted by a negative expose that was about to come out here in San Francisco, the atmosphere and environment, it completely changed. Jim Jones came down right before this expose came out that was going to talk about physical and sexual abuse in the church, about financial misdeeds. And so he decided to get all of the members out of San Francisco before that magazine hit the newsstands. Because he was so terrified. It was like for the first time he was going to be exposed for what he was, a fraud. So there was this huge effort under cover of night to get all of the members moved from their communes in San Francisco down to Guyana. They would load up busloads in the middle of the night from the church parking lot, drive them to the airport, and fly them down. And then he flew down himself. And shortly after he moved down, a year before the massacre, he's already talking to them about having to commit revolutionary suicide, that someday they're going to have to die. And when he first introduces the notion, of course, you know, nobody knows what he's talking about. You know, they move down there to begin a better life, to have more freedom for their children, to have equality. And so there are these arguments every night with Jim Jones about, you know, we want to defend our community. We came down here, you know, to improve our lives. And Jim Jones is telling them, well, no, actually, someday we have to prepare to commit revolutionary suicide. So he's already trying to convince them that this is something that is inevitable. And I can imagine, I'm sure you can too, how terrifying that must have been, thinking that you're going down there to participate in this great, you know, idea, this great commune of equality, essentially, this agricultural project, and then getting down there and realizing that your leader has gone mad and they want to kill you. In fact, they are planning it and talking about it as if it's going to be inevitable.
And this is, it seems like this is, and again, an important point to make here, that when that idea was introduced, that there were people who stood up and said, wait a minute.
Yes.
This is not why we came here. This is not, we don't think this is the
right.
What we should be doing, and that the fact that they were stuck there, that they were trapped, and also that Jim Jones had armed enforcers to help to keep people in line, that's what happened.
Well, he used many tactics to keep people in line, and one thing he did was that he told the residents they were surrounded by these armed mercenaries in the jungle, so they didn't dare stray or try and escape Jonestown between, you know, the pythons and the big cats that roamed the jungle. There were these armed mercenaries who hated their ideals so much that they were waiting to kill them if they stepped into the jungle. And what he would do is that he would send his son into the jungle to shoot back on the camp and make it seem as if it was real, the threat was real. And, of course, the residents had no idea what was going on. It's just Jim Jones saying over the loudspeakers, we're under attack, we're under attack, and having his son shoot down, you know, bullets into the camp. So there was a lot of mind control that went on all along the many months that happened before the massacre. There were many ways that he controlled people. There was sleep deprivation. There was depriving them of protein. You know, there was one woman who kept a daily journal in Jonestown, and she is one of the people I feature in my book, And she talks about making her way through the food line and having like a piece of pineapple on her plate, after working all day. This is the amount of calories that they get. So there was that. And there was also, it became obvious that Jim Jones, you know, during these nightly discussions about revolutionary suicide, he started holding votes. And he wouldn't let anyone go to bed until everyone raised their hand that they were willing to commit revolutionary suicide. And it got to the point that people realized this. And for them, it was more important to get a couple of hours of sleep because they knew the next day they were going to be working in the fields all day than it was to fight with Jim Jones anymore.
But they understood, though, that they really understand that.
They didn't want to die. They didn't want to die, but they wanted to get some sleep because they knew that he wasn't going to let anyone go to bed until everybody raised their hand in favor of committing revolutionary suicide.
But was there this feeling? Did they understand that there was no way that they were going to be able to put up any kind of real fight, and that that everybody knew how it was going to turn out?
Well, he held a drill in May before the November mass murder, where he had people line up and drink what was essentially unsugared Kool-Aid.
Hmm.
And on that night, people were scared, and they argued and protested. And those people who protested, they were the first ones in line. So, you know, they believed that they were going to die. And they had the guards marching them up there with their guns, saying, drink this, or you're going to be shot. And so they would take, during this drill, they would have people drink it, and they would go into hysterics, thinking they were dying, and then they would lead them into this field outside the pavilion and lay them down. Pretty soon it became obvious people weren't dying. They were, you know, itching themselves on the grass and trying to get comfortable as they were laying down. So when the last night happened, you know, a lot of people thought, well, you know, maybe this is another drill. And they didn't realize until the children who were first in line started dying that it was real.
So how did we were just talking a little bit about the first person that you talked to was Tommy Bogue, who went there when he was a teenager with his dad. How did he manage to get away?
Well, Tommy Bogue, you know, I have had a kindred spirit with him because I was a rebellious teenager who resented going to church as a kid as well. He actually ran away with another kid from Jonestown in November of 1977, so a year before the massacre happened. These two teenage boys, you know, they came up with a ruse and fled Jonestown. And Tommy had been studying how to survive in the jungle from the local Amerindians. So they would teach him, you know, this is a vine that you can cut and drink the sap. You know, this is how you can fish with this poisonous bulb. You throw it in the water and it stuns the fish, and then you can grab them out with your hand. So he was learning, actively learning how to survive in the jungle and planning to escape. And then the moment came, you know, the two boys escape, and they made good headway until darkness fell. And then, you know, I have been to Jonestown, what remains of it, and the jungle is so dense that you cannot walk a foot without, you know, tripping or running into a sapling or something else. So when darkness came, then they could no longer make progress, and they were found by the security guards when they came back to the main road. So he was taken back and punished along with his best friend Brian Davis. And meanwhile, his dad also started planning on getting his children out of there. His dad was one of the pioneers of Jonestown, was sent down there with the early crew to clear cut the forest and build the cottages and everything else, plant the crops. So his dad came up with a plan with one of his buddies to escape and help get their families out of there. So they were actually cutting a trail through the jungle when Congressman Leo Ryan came down to investigate claims that people were being held against their will. So they ended up leaving with the congressman instead of taking that path that they had cut out of the jungle.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Julia Shears. She's a journalist She is author of a recently published book, A Thousand Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown, and it's just published by Free Press. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Is it okay to break up with someone over email? If you're out at a restaurant, is it rude to answer your cell phone or update your Facebook status? On the next Fresh Air, we get answers from Philip Galanis, who writes an etiquette column for the New York Times and has a new book. Both are called Social Cues. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Jarman Center, Tuscola; Natural Gourmet, Champaign; Fertilizer Dealer Supply, Philo; and Strategic Farm Marketing, Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, our guest will be Phyllis Wise. She's the chancellor of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She has been on the job now for a few months. We'll talk with her about some of her first impressions of the university and also generally about some of the big issues confronting people who are administrators in big colleges and universities. Then in the second hour, we will look at some of the challenges of providing quality care in nursing homes. And we'll have two guests with us: Christopher Casper, who is the administrator of Country Health Care and Rehabilitation in Gifford, and also Chuck Shute. He's an administrator of the Champaign County Nursing Home. We are here weekday mornings again, as I say, from 10 to noon. You can check the schedule by going to the website. That way you can also listen to past programs. And that is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour, we're talking with Julia Shears. She's a writer, a journalist. Her work has appeared in a number of places, including the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, the Guardian, and other publications. Her first book was a memoir, Jesus Land, and her newest book is A Thousand Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. The Free Press is the publisher. It's just come out just recently. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And email, that's also a possibility. You want to send in a question or a comment that way. The address is willtalk@illinois.edu. I do have a question here that came in by email from someone who writes that they remember having seen a television movie on Jonestown and Jim Jones that they said they thought dated from the early 80s. At least the person said that they were a teenager at the time that they saw this. They were just wondering if you had seen it and whether you had anything to say on that or other popular accounts of Jim Jones.
Yeah, I know the television movie she's referring to. I believe it starred Powers Booth as Jim Jones.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of bad movies and specials about People's Temple with a lot of recreations and imaginings of what the last night would have been like. And that's why I really strove in my book to cite everything I used.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is no conjecture. This is all based on evidence and documents and interviews. Because, you know, the interpretations, and especially the Hollywood interpretations of what happened, are so fraught, I wanted there to be a true record, you know, of what happened, especially that last night. So one of the people that I interview was someone who actually escaped the mass murder under the guise of saying, you know, he got in line, he realized that this wasn't a drill. People were actually dying. And this is Stanley Clayton, is a young man from Oakland, mm-hmm. with street smarts when he came to the temple. And he found it within himself to get out of that, you know, out of the line, out of the brightly lit pavilion where everyone was gathered, and then outside were these rows of security guards with weapons. So under the ruse of saying goodbye to the medical team, which was mixing up more poison in one of the school tents, he managed to escape, run off into the jungle, and hide. So his witness and his, you know, the interviews that I did with him really form what happened that last night, as well as Jim Jones recorded everything when he was speaking to his followers in Jonestown. He most often would record it, and he recorded that last night. So you can hear him saying, you know, the congressman has been shot, the media who came with the congressman have been shot, and now the Guyanese army is about to invade. We need to take this potion and cross over to the other side. He told them that he believed in reincarnation. And so, you know, it's all there on tape. And one remarkable thing was that he edited the tape some 30 times before, you know, hitting the off button and killing himself. And so what was he editing out? What he was editing out were all of the people who were protesting what was going on. That's what I believe. He only wanted the historical record to show that these people willingly died. I mean, that was the setup, that everybody willingly died in Jonestown that night. And what I found was far from the truth. One of the most shocking things that I found were dozens of notes to Jim Jones from residents saying, please let me go home. I didn't know it was going to be like this. Or, I'm miserable here. Please just let me go home. My child is terrified. I don't know how to tell them that death is a good thing. I'll do whatever you ask. I'll give you my money for the rest of my life. Just let me go back to California. And again, he refusing to let anyone out.
Yeah, I remember, this is now many years ago, I think it was actually not that long after the events at Jonestown, we ran here on our station a radio documentary, what I thought was a very powerful piece, that used some of that tape.
Yeah.
And you got to hear some of these long harangues, these night-long things that he would put people through of self-criticism and confession. And and you could hear him in his own voice and hear the things that he was saying. And it was really, really frightening, just really frightening.
It is. I have some of those audio samples on my website if people want to listen to them or even see some home movies that he was sending back to California to lure more people down there. My website is just my name, www.juliascheers.com. And there's a couple choice audio tapes, including one where he is denouncing the Bible and announcing his new philosophy of apostolic socialism, is what he called it.
Well, I have another caller here. Let's bring them into the conversation, someone who is in Urbana, here where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I use the PBS documentary in a course that I teach in religious studies every semester, so I've watched that numerous times, which features a lot of interviews with, I think there were four survivors who were present that day who did not go along with, you know, what happened. They escaped, and then others who were members but were not present that day. And one of the things that I find very haunting about the whole story is there was some very high-functioning people involved in Jonestown, because you don't go down to Guyana and create out of nothing in the jungle a community of, you know, 1,000 people with water and food and housing and all of these sorts of things. So one of the things that disturbs me is, you know, Jones himself is an object of study as sort of this narcissistic person who gets a lot of people to do what he wants. But what bothers me is the other people who had a lot of skills in engineering, education, healthcare, who could be successful in sort of any sort of vocation they chose, who were part of this. And on the extensive tapes, you know, there's a woman just before they start with the killing who's sort of challenging him, you know, what about going to Russia and so on. And he, you know, talks back to her, but there's sort of a popular outcry against her, and you can hear the audience shouting her down.
Right.
And, you know, certainly there was a lot of murder going on that day because you've got children and people who are not of an age to you have to count that as murder. But there was an alarming number of adults who had the skills necessary to function very well outside of Jonestown who were willing participants. There's just no way around that. And that's what I find very haunting about this story. And then of the survivors, both the four who were present that day and others who were members but not there that day, the sort of lack of bitterness about their overall experience. And there's one person right at the end of that video who's saying, you know, well, you know, it didn't work. And, you know, I'm sad about that, you know, but we tried. And I can always say that we tried, even though we weren't able to build this socialist society that we were trying to. And that's haunting to me, the sort of, it says that there was a lot of pathology there, but there was also a lot of people who were leading, I don't know what the term is, fulfilled lives or something. There was kind of wistfulness there in some of the people that were interviewed, you know, and that disturbed me more than Jim Jones himself. I think that he's a pretty predictable sort of type, and you can see them through history. Do you have any reflections on that?
Right. Well, I think as far as the wistfulness, I mean, they wished that the dream of this beautiful society, 70s society, would have come true. I mean, that's why they participated in People's Temple, and that's why they moved down to Jonestown, was because they believed in social justice and all the right things. So, you know, they wished that that could have been true. I think that's what you're feeling when you hear them interviewed. As far as your first question about people shouting down Christine Miller, there was one voice on the death tape, as it's called, of the last night of Christine Miller, who stands up and tells Jim Jones, "I believe everyone has a right to determine their own destiny," and argues with him against revolutionary suicide. And she is shouted down. But what you have to remember is that Jim Jones has been, you know, bringing these people along for months around to his viewpoint. So they believe him when he says there are mercenaries in the jungle that are about to attack them and torture their children. And so it is easier to drink this potion and quickly, as he says, go to the other side. They believe him. He has been their one source of information in Jonestown for a year now. They don't have radio. They don't have TV. They don't have telephones. There's one ham radio, and he controls it.
Yeah,
so all of their outside news comes from Jim Jones.
There were people traveling in and out all the time, so the basketball team was on tour. That's why his adoptive son is gone. And, I mean, it's true that he keeps a lot of control, but there were lots of other people there. One person can't, you know, manage that large of an operation without a lot of assistance. And, you know, some of these people are the ones that that didn't strike me as pathological. And there was, you know, it's true that you couldn't turn on a radio and listen to the news and so on, but there were a lot of people in addition to Jim Jones who had a lot of influence in what was happening there. And some of the language referring to going on to the other side, I mean, that's sort of a basic Christian idea, is that, you know, you don't die when you die physically, but one way or another you continue to exist. So I can see where it's not that hard to sell people on that, even though he might have had some other sorts of theories about reincarnation. But, you know, 90% of Americans believe that when they die, they're not dead. So that's not tough. I'm just intrigued and bothered by the 3 dozen other people who provided leadership there. And they didn't prevail against him.
That's true. His inner circle had the same depressive, nihilistic outlook that he did. And therefore, you know, he talks about, how are we going to kill everyone? That was a problem. They didn't know how to kill everyone in Jonestown. He flat out said, we don't have enough ammunition to shoot everyone, so he assigned the medical department to be creative and to look into it. And the person who helmed that effort was the doctor, the camp doctor, Larry Schacht, who on Wednesdays, you know, stopped delivering babies and, you know, giving shots, and went into his lab and started to grow cultures. He tried to grow the botulism culture, you know, staphylococci cultures, and then came up with cyanide as the best way to kill everyone. So you're right. He did have this inner core that believed in his, what he called, you know, his last stand. It was this secret plan that, again, the rank and file didn't know anything about, but the inner core did. They knew. I found these memos from the early 70s where they knew he was planning on having what he called the last stand of orchestrating this mass suicide to protest capitalism and to show support of socialism. They knew it, and they helped him. So you are right in that sense, yes.
We just have about 5 minutes left. I appreciate the comments of the caller. I have one more person I want to try to get in here on the cell phone. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Brad, I was. You'd made several references to armed security guards who were patrolling and keeping everyone from getting out of line. What happened to them? Did they drink the Kool-Aid?
Yes, they drank the poison as well.
Okay, I didn't know if it was. I didn't know if they disappeared into the jungle or what. But I was just curious. So they had bought into it.
Yeah, well, they believed. Again, Jim Jones was telling them, you know, hurry, hurry, the Guyanese army is coming in. They're going to come and torture our children and kill us. Quickly, quickly, drink the potion that will bring you to the other side before they get here. They believed him when when he was telling them these things, the same thing as having the armed mercenaries circling them in the jungle. It was his son who was shooting back on the camp. I mean, they didn't know anything beyond what Jim Jones told them. He told them that African Americans were being castrated in the streets of Chicago. He would just make things up about America. America is so horrible, you don't want to go back there. You are lucky to be here in Jonestown. So he really deprived them of any hope and sense of a future while they were down there.
So all of the people who you might call his enablers, the people that were his security, the people that were in his inner circle, they all died?
They did. Well, the basketball team, as that one caller referred to, his son, he had a biological son, Stephen, who would get in his face. He was the one person who was allowed to get in his face and argue with him against revolutionary suicide. And conveniently, that son, an adopted son, and a bunch of the other able-bodied young men were on the basketball team and were sent to Georgetown, the capital of Guyana, for a basketball tournament. Before all of this went down.
And was that planned, or was that just a happenstance?
Well, there is some sense that it was planned because Jones' wife, Marceline, pressed a passport with a lot of money into Stephen Jones' hand as they were leaving. And when she said goodbye to him, there was a sense that this was a final goodbye. Bye.
Just going back to the thing that people are try to understand is that the followers, the people who followed Jim Jones, why it was they did. And I think particularly, say, of somebody like Stanley Clayton, I'm sure that there were people who would have said that up to a certain point, they would have said their association with Jim Jones and the People's Temple had actually been very good for them.
Oh, Stanley Clayton. Bless his heart, he lives about half a mile away from me here in Berkeley in a homeless shelter for the mentally ill. I mean, he was destroyed after Jonestown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jim Jones got him out, bailed him out of jail on more than one occasion, put a roof over his head, fed him, sent him to get his GED. And these small things for someone like Stanley Clayton meant a lot. Now, he came from this broken home with an alcoholic mom and was always in trouble with the law. And People's Temple really put him in the straight and narrow and you know, provided him with an education and these other benefits. And when I was reviewing some of these home movies from Jonestown with him, he just broke down. He misses all of those people. He's never felt as cared for as he did when he was in the church.
So that would can you even use that to that kind of feeling to explain why it is that people say people who didn't have those sort of disadvantages, people who were well educated, people who had maybe strong political values, why they would have been associated with Jim Jones?
Well, that's right. You know, another person that I profile is this middle-aged woman who has an MA in creative writing. She's white, and she joins church because she believes it's the right thing to do. She believes in social justice and helping African Americans and other minorities. And, you know, you reflect back to the 70s, there was so much strife around, you know, racial justice and social justice, and she believed it was the right thing to do. And so she joined and ended up in Jonestown, tried to go home, sent Jones notes saying, please let me go home, I'll, you know, send all my paychecks to you, and he wouldn't have it. Mm-hmm. She is the one who kept the diary every day in Jonestown and talks about the deteriorating situation, how there's less and less food, and, you know, how she disagrees with revolutionary suicide. She writes in her diary, and yet she's on tape saying she supports it because she knows she's expected to say that.
We're at the point we have to finish here. I'm curious now just because we talked about how you had initially been thinking about writing a novel.
Yes.
That's got you thinking about creating this charismatic Indiana minister, and then that got you thinking about Jim Jones, who was a real charismatic Indiana minister. Have you abandoned all plans of ever writing that novel?
Well, I had actually a draft done of it, so I might go back to it. It was a lot easier just to make things up instead of having to cite every little detail of a book, that's for sure.
Well, our guest, Julia Shears, her book is recently published, A Thousand Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. The book is published by Free Press. She is a journalist who's also written for a number of publications, including the L.A. Times, the New York Times, The Guardian. She is the author of another book. Her first book was a memoir, Jesus Land. And Ms. Shears, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.